Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, a podcast that aims to address divorce, separation and co-parenting here in the UK, countering the often sensationalist way it's portrayed in the media, challenging the status quo and driving for reform. On each episode, I'm joined by experts to discuss divorce, separation and co-parenting from different angles and to give their opinions and to debate them. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor and divorce coach, co-founder of Amicable, the divorce services company, and host of this, the Divorce Podcast. In this episode, I was joined by Tracy Maloney, known to many as the Legal Queen on TikTok and other social media platforms. Tracy's worked in family law for almost 20 years and has practiced as both a barrister and a solicitor in Australia and here in the UK. She was head of the family department for a nationwide legal firm and is an associate lecturer in family law at the University of Bristol. Through her appearances on social, Tracy provides a clear explanation of people's legal rights around family law matters, and she helps them to navigate the legal system itself. We spent this episode busting common divorce and separation myths, such as whether or not you need a solicitor to get divorced, when a financial order is needed in divorce proceedings, if common law spouses exist, and whether cohabiting couples have rights to property. I absolutely love myth busting with Tracy, and I've invited her back to do more, so watch this space for future episodes. If you really loved this episode or want to hear more episodes like this, then please make sure to rate us on your preferred listening platform. Enjoy the episode. Welcome, Tracy.
Hello, Kate. Hello. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's brilliant to have you. And we're going to bust some myths today. But just before we get on to that, debunking divorce myths, just tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit about yourself. I said in the intro that you had practiced in Australia as well as the UK. How did that come about?
That was many years ago. So myself and my husband decided that we would emigrate over there. My husband has some family over there. And we spent about 6 years there. So that's how I came to practice in Australia, thoroughly enjoyed it. But then, yes, eventually we did come back to the UK, just because there's family here too, I suppose, and we miss them. But yeah, it was a good experience, I think, and it really broadened my depth and my knowledge of family law. I think from a cultural perspective as well, it also gave me a better understanding of what people need.
Well, that's interesting. So because you had the opportunity to work with a slightly different culture, you think it enabled you to get under the skin of people, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think when you stay or when you're in practice with particularly one community, you're not able really to understand how other traditions and other cultures operate. So I think by being able to practice over in Australia, you know, traditions are different. You know, their society works very differently to how our society works. The norms here are not necessarily the norms there. So whilst the law is the same, the principles of the law were largely similar, how we applied those principles was very different. So that was really interesting for me, just for my profession, very interesting.
Yeah, because I think people get stuck in a rut, don't they, sometimes with the legal advice they give and the solutions they come up with. And you're right, actually, just trying to think about different creative solutions. That must have added so much to the way you could help people in terms of creativity and coming up with ideas that perhaps, like you say, aren't the norm here, but why wouldn't they work?
Exactly. And I think I had the added bonus of when I was in Australia, I practiced as a barrister. So I really did get to see the court system, what the judges were looking for, how people are really put under pressure in cross-examination. And I think it's really helped me then as a solicitor, because when I offer a client advice, I can also offer them some guidance as to what to expect within the court system. You know, what they can expect to go through if they're under cross-examination, how to maybe get on the good side of a judge, because obviously I spent many years practicing and delivering my client's situation to the judge. So I think that's also helped, having practiced on both sides.
Yes, I can imagine. It must make you a very valuable resource for people.
Well, just...
And one of the things that you're most kind of, I guess, known for now is your sort of wow performance on TikTok. How did you get into all of that social media stuff then? Because your moniker is the Legal Queen. How did that come about?
So I was actually still working at my last role. I headed up the family department for a nationwide firm, as you said in your introduction, Kate. And during lockdown, my four sons started TikTok. And they are the four brothers. So they became very well known, have done incredibly well. And it was their fault, really, when I left my role and there was a period where I wasn't able to work just because of my contract. And they said to me, look, but while you're sat around doing nothing, Mom, in lockdown, why don't you go on TikTok? And I was, don't be so silly. You know, no one's going to want to listen to the law. That's so boring. But we had a think about it, and I thought, actually, okay, I will help people to. My thinking, Kate, if I'm honest, was because I used to practice legal aid, and then legal aid was largely abolished for family law. There are so many people who can't afford legal representation, but are stuck in the system. So they have no option but to represent themselves, and they don't know where to start. If they do get started, they get stuck in the middle and don't really understand. And the court's not there to advise them. The court is simply there to listen to their case. So that was the motivation behind me starting TikTok. It was to help those people that couldn't afford legal representation, but to also explain what you can do. There were so many people saying, but, you know, I'm not getting contact with my child. So how do I take that to the court? Is there a step before court, i.e. mediation? And I was quite overwhelmed when I started doing the videos at the feedback that I got. People really loved this, and more people wanted to watch it and learn about it. And it was really helping people. And it just took off from there, really, Kate. There was no big plan with TikTok. It was just to fill a gap during lockdown, if I'm perfectly honest.
Isn't that somehow how the best ideas come about, though, isn't it? By accident.
Yes.
History is littered with accidents that have turned out to be amazing ideas. And I'm not going to be rude or disingenuous here, but you're not of that generation, are you? You're not a digital native.
No, so absolutely not.
It's quite a brave thing then if you have to learn that sort of digital technology. What was that like for you actually stepping out and saying, okay, I'm going to do something that's a platform that's not my natural space to communicate?
You know, it was really alien to me. And again, only because the boys were all here at home, because we were in lockdown, that they were able to coach me through. But honestly, Kate, when I first started, I didn't even know how to record a TikTok video. What it's helped me identify with, though, is that it's a great way to actually deliver a legal service. My profession is very traditional. It's steeped in history. And it, you know, I think a combination of social media, but also lockdown, has helped me reset the way we deliver legal services. Because actually, people are more than happy to watch somebody on TikTok or Instagram and then reach out to me for an appointment. They're more than happy to do that. Whereas had you said that to me a couple of years ago, I would say absolutely not. People have got to come into the office. They've got to see a receptionist. They want to see you in a boardroom. And only then will they have the confidence in your ability to actually represent them.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because you're right. It's that in typical legal service delivery, there is so much kind of bolstering and fluff around it, isn't there? There's this whole idea that it's a very traditional thing, that you've got to be very learned, that, you know, you've got to be wearing a suit, you've got to have a big office, there's got to be rows of leather-bound books behind you. It's all, you know, there are a lot of people's kind of impression of the law is that it is really them and us. And I think what your TikTok does is just bring people together, doesn't it, to have a conversation rather than somebody talking at you.
Yes, it does. And I think the other thing that social media has taught me, particularly by doing the TikToks, is that some people have almost a fear of solicitors. Not afraid of the person, but they're afraid of the costs. They're afraid of asking for help because they feel that they're going to have this huge bill at the end of it. And to be able to break it down and say, look, we can deliver a legal service in a way that we can do everything for you, or we can simply be on the side and help you. It's of great comfort to people because those that are on a budget and maybe have a couple of £100 to spend can say, well, actually, can I just get a consultation? Can you help me understand what it is that I need to do? I don't actually need you to represent me in court. I just need you to help me with the forms to fill out, and I'll take it from there. And I think that has given me the greatest satisfaction. that it hasn't got to be this all or nothing approach that is the traditional idea behind the legal services, solicitors and barristers, etc.
Yeah, because that's when it speaks to access to justice, doesn't it? When everybody has access rather than just the people who can afford to pay. And you're right, when legal aid went, there were so many people that got left behind, unable to afford things, as you say. So what a great way of being able to reach people. So in your TikTok videos, and I've watched a couple of them, they're fantastic. Just for people who haven't yet been able to see them, what sort of topics can you break down into a TikTok length video?
So the three areas that I focus on will be children, divorce, and finances that flow from divorce. So i.e. who gets the house and who gets the pension, etc. So they're the three sort of umbrellas, if you like. And then within that, I'll break it down. So typically, it started with I do one video and then I would get asked questions beneath that video. And it might be from a father that says, I am unable to see my child. How do I start the application? So I would start by saying, OK, fill out the C100 and then submit that to the court. Prior to that, however, you have to attempt mediation. Then there might be another question. Well, what's mediation? What's involved there? So I almost started, Kate, by taking my lead as to what to talk about from the questions that I was being asked. And then it's very easy for me, I think, because I've spent a large majority of my career training, you know, young trainee solicitors or paralegals, it was very easy for me to then convey that into a 30-second or a 60-minute TikTok. I think the thing to remember, especially on the social media, is that people don't want the legalities of it. They want it in plain English. They want to be able to do it themselves. The other thing that I just wanted to mention as well is that you mentioned a few moments ago, Kate, about when legal aid was taken away. It did take away that access to justice element. What it also did was completely, well, it assisted in clogging up our family court system. Because you have the layperson that doesn't really understand what's required of them and what is needed from them during a court hearing, everything slowed down. So there's this huge backlog and potentially unnecessary applications within the system, you know, because the lay people simply don't understand. So I think it helps as well for people to understand it so that we can speed up our legal system again and help to break the back of that clogging up, for want of a better phrase, really, that's what's happened. You know, we are waiting months and months to get a hearing date for an hour of court time, which was never the case when I first went into practice 20 odd years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's in a terrible, terrible state, and it's impacting on people's lives, because if you're waiting months and months and you've got young children and you're missing time with them, or you're in a situation where you need a financial hearing or whatever, you're living in limbo, aren't you? And it creates a huge amount of pain. And also it compounds the problem and leads to more applications, doesn't it? So it's very self-defeating. The whole system is really broken.
It is. It really is. And of course, it's not just about the parent. If we stay with the children example, it's not just about the parent who is missing contact. It's also the children, you know, because while mom and dad are in dispute, the children are actually missing out on a relationship with that other parent. So you're right. It just compounds everything. And I think what sometimes gets missed is that social media would have us believe if you don't agree, particularly in family matters, you run straight to court. And that's not necessarily the case. You know, we have to explore other avenues to collaborate and to try and co-parent. So I'm a real big advocate for mediation, you know, really big, not just to assist the court system, but also, you know, the court can't fix everything. You know, the court's not going to help parents co-parent. They're just going to give you an order that you have to follow. But if you don't follow the order, we haven't really fixed the problem.
Yeah. And, you know, we say that to people all the time when they talk about wanting to get an order. The implementation and if you have to go back to enforce it, you just go around in circles forever and a day. So, yeah, I totally agree. We strong advocates, obviously, from the amicable perspective of court being a last resort, or for people where there is no alternative because there's abuse or because there's, you know, hidden assets or intractable dispute. But absolutely, I think exploring the other ways of sorting out financial or children issues is an absolute must. And, you know, from our perspective, we think that should be the starting point for everybody, unless there's a really clear exemption.
Absolutely.
But let's bust some myths then, because we were going to do a myth-busting session today. So I've got some kind of typical myths, and feel free to add any that I miss. But the first one I've got is, divorce is complicated and you must have a solicitor. Is that a myth or is that true?
It's an absolute myth. I mean, particularly now that we have our new no-fault divorce that came in on the 6th of April, very easy. You know, you can log into the court website now. You can fill out your own divorce petition. You really don't need a solicitor anymore. You know, if the marriage has broken down irretrievably, so be it. So no, complete myth that one, Kate.
Brilliant. Yep. And then the government system is super, super easy to use, isn't it? You can choose a joint or a sole application. As you say, we're in a no-fault system, so we don't need any more to say the reason the marriage has broken down. And then it's just an administrative process where you have to have a 20-week waiting period followed by a 6-week waiting period. So it takes a little bit longer, but much more simplified and straightforward. And you're right, there is no need to get any help with doing a straightforward divorce.
Correct. Yeah.
So then the next myth then, if you get divorced, you've ended your financial relationship with each other.
So no, all the divorce will do is sever that marriage, and it will legally allow you to remarry again. What it doesn't do is sever that financial relationship between the pair of you, which from my experience, a lot of people don't even realize a financial relationship exists when you get divorced. And this is the big one for me, because until you've got that financial order, what that means is that either one of you can make a financial claim against the other at any time. At any time, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years past having received a decree absolute or final order, as it's now called.
I think this is the one for me that I think there's a lot of people that just don't realise that they think that just because if you get divorced, that's it and that's the end of it. It genuinely isn't. And sometimes people don't realise as well, it applies to pensions and things like that too. So you might have a pension that your spouse has never had anything to do with, but they're still entitled to make a claim against it in the future if you haven't had a financial order. So I think it is a really big myth, that one, isn't it?
It really is. And I think it's spreading the word on that area, because it can potentially be disappointing. You know, if you think that you've got your decree absolute, sorry, your final order, and, you know, the other person comes back 10 years later, it can be devastating. Devastating to then when you've moved on potentially and, you know, started to build your life again, that actually they can make a claim against that.
And it feels messy, doesn't it, knowing that you've got that hanging over you and that it could happen at any time. So it's, we always say to people, if you have any sort of financial assets, you should definitely be ending your financial claims against each other. And that's called having a clean break, isn't it? Putting a clean break in.
Well, I was just going to say, Kate, because so there's another section of the community that think, oh, well, we don't need the financial order trace because actually we don't have anything to divide. But I always say in that instance, that's where you need your clean break. So the clean break is a financial order, but it's where you have nothing to be divided between you both. Now, where there are assets to be divided or things that need to happen in the future, for example, you know, the house will be sold when the youngest is 18, it's a financial order. So, you know, even those that have no assets to divide, I'm still going to encourage them to get a clean break financial order.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that then is your belt and braces you cannot be claimed against in the future.
Absolutely.
And what happens if you remarry? Because if you do remarry, some claims stop, don't they? So just explain that.
Absolutely. So there is a bar. Generally, there is a bar to making a financial claim once you have remarried. So, you know, husband and wife divorce, wife goes off to remarry. Her ability to then claim, make a financial claim against the husband is almost non-existent, really, because she's now remarried. She's lost that opportunity. But of course, it doesn't mean because husband, in my example, hasn't remarried, that he then can't come back and make a claim against her. And of course, if she has now remarried, then her new husband is going to be part of that claim. So it just becomes very messy, very messy.
So definitely. So the advice from both of us here would be, make sure you don't just see divorce as the end of it, but get your financial order, get your clean break order.
Absolutely.
And make sure that you're protected, even if you think your financial situation is simple and straightforward,
yeah,
it's something that can come back and bite you.
Definitely it can. Definitely.
So the next myth, is there such a thing as a common law husband or wife?
No. So I get asked this all the time. People live together, they own a property together, but they never actually get married. There is no such thing as common law man and wife. If you don't have a marriage certificate, you are not married. If you haven't gone through an official wedding ceremony and ticked all the boxes that we consider to be a legally recognized marriage, then you're not married at all. And again, people can be quite disappointed by this, particularly those that are in long-term relationships, so sort of 20, 25 years and not married, and the family home is only in one person's name. The relationship breaks down and the person who doesn't have their name on the property says, yeah, but it's okay because 50% of it's still mine, isn't it? And you have to break the news to them that actually, no, you walk away with absolutely nothing. Unless you can prove you've made a significant financial contribution, you have no claim to the property. How heartbreaking is that, Kate, after giving 20 odd years of your life to this relationship, you know, and investing in it, not just financially, because, you know, that's a real bugbear for me. In a marriage, we look at all contributions, not just financial. But in a cohabiting relationship, it's purely the financial contribution that we're looking at. That's just so sad, isn't it?
It feels really one-sided. And I think you're right. I just think there are many people caught in that situation. They just don't realise how vulnerable they are under the current laws.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's quite scary, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, our laws in that area, particularly of cohabitees, they need a huge overhaul. They really do. They really need to be looked at and brought right up into the 21st century. They're trailing behind, even I would say, the rest of the world. We need to look at that.
Well, that's the next big thing, isn't it? Now we've achieved no-fault divorce, the next thing on the sort of reform agenda must be cohabiting laws. And you'll know from being in Australia, they're quite different in places like Australia. And you say we lag behind the rest of the world because we offer no protection.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's interesting because statistics tell us that fewer people are actually getting married. More and more people are beginning families and putting their focus on perhaps getting on the property ladder. Marriage isn't a big thing as it used to be. You know, culturally, we're changing. It's not seen as a must as it was, say, back in the 60s or 70s. You know, people...
Well, it's no longer the gateway to sex and it's no longer the gateway to economic survival, is it? That's the point. So
yes.
If you take those two things out of it, you can survive economically and you don't need to be married to have sex. So, yeah, it becomes a much different choice, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is the big red flag for me. You know, statistically, marriages are going down. Therefore, more couples are living together. Therefore, more protection is needed if, for example, only one of them is named on the property. Absolutely.
And cohabiting relationships are more likely to break down than marriages are as well, aren't they? So that puts more people in a more vulnerable state more of the time, if you like. So it ratchets up the number of people who are kind of at risk of something quite catastrophic financially happening to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, particularly in England and Wales, we do see statistically more cohabiting couples, that relationship breaking down than divorce, which is quite alarming.
And what does adding children into the mix do?
Well, I was going to actually say there, Kate, following on from my last point, you know, what does that mean for the children? Because if you're married, then the children's housing needs almost become priority when we're doing divorce and a financial settlement. But of course, if you're not married, we are just looking at financial contribution. So let's say the person who's not named on that property in a cohabiting relationship is the one who's going to be the primary care of the children. What can they do? There is an ability for them to make an application under Schedule 1 of the Children's Act, but they're very expensive applications to make. They're quite complex applications. They're quite difficult applications to make. So it's not for the faint-hearted, Kate. You know, it's very easy for us to say there is a remedy available to you. If you don't have a property in your name, the relationship ends down, breaks down, and the children are going to live with you. But actually accessing that remedy is quite another thing, really, if I'm perfectly honest. It's a difficult and expensive application. Tolata, which is the Schedule 1 angle of that, I don't do a lot on, because it's difficult to break that down. It's difficult to break down a schedule. It falls under a different set of rules from family rules for a start. So it's very difficult to break that down to the layperson. And my advice, interestingly, or my suggestions to anybody who's asking me about a Schedule 1, or in layman's terms, how do I get some money to help rehouse the children, is you really should go and see a solicitor for this. You know, because trying to coach somebody through doing that on their own would be near impossible. It's not an easy application, even for solicitors, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it's because it is so complicated, you do need that specific legal advice, because everyone's circumstances are so different, whether you've made any contributions, you know, how old the children are, all of those things are going to impact on that kind of application, aren't they? And I think the other thing to say is it's only the housing provision that you can get any help with, even if you've got kids, isn't it? You're not entitled to anything else. So pension contribution, anything. If you've taken 15, 20 years out of your career to raise children, there is no compensation for that at all in terms of pension share or anything.
Absolutely.
So you really are in a very, very vulnerable position.
Yeah.
If people are listening to this and thinking, oh my goodness, is there anything you can do to protect your position once you're in a cohabiting relationship with kids?
Well, the first thing I'd be suggesting is, why aren't you named on the mortgage? You know, if this is going to be a long-term relationship, then discuss that with your partner and say, look, you know, I see this as our home. The intention is it's going to be our home. I'm investing by way of, you know, looking after the children and creating the home and et cetera. But I need to afford some protection for myself. So I think I really do need to be named on the mortgage, actually, as a joint owner of the property. And I think that discussion needs to be had. I'll share a case with you that really illustrates the point, Kate. I had a client who was fairly wealthy. He'd been in a 22-year relationship. They had met when they were sort of 17, 18 and had two children. The relationship broke down. They weren't married, and the relationship broke down when the children were sort of 10 and 8. And she had made an application under Schedule 1 of the Children's Act, because the home that they'd always lived in was his, not hers. And the court, it went through various hearings, but the final order was made whereby he bought her a house outright, and he was lucky enough to be able to do that, for $350,000, but it was in his name. And when the youngest child reached 18, she had to move out. I mean, obviously, it was a great result for my client, but I've never forgotten that, because on reflection, like you've just said, that poor woman is still so vulnerable, simply because there was no wedding certificate in the midst of all this. Had there been a wedding certificate, her position would have been very different, because
yeah, well,
this particular gentleman,
yeah.
Completely the opposite. She would have walked away with probably 70% of his assets, which were substantial, and ran into the millions, you know? So,
and a mortgage-free home and income and et cetera, wouldn't she? Yeah.
Absolutely. So as a practitioner, it really does make you reflect and think, we have to have change here. We have to have change.
Well, I think there's two things in there. We have to have change, and as citizens, we have to get better at understanding what marriage, not marriage, what it all means, in not just from a romantic perspective, but when we go into these relationships, we are changing our legal status. And I think, you know, when I hear people complaining about having to share half of what they consider to be theirs, they've missed the point that marriage actually is a sharing, is a legal sharing, and therefore that it's no longer theirs, that you're an us, you're not an I. And pensions, whether they're in your name or whatever, are marital assets. And I think that understanding as a society, we have to get better at being able to explain that, so people, when they choose to cohabit or choose to marry, they understand what that means. They don't just plan a wedding or a moving in or a house purchase, but they actually grasp what it means legally and what the consequences of something going wrong are, because nobody wants to think of the consequences of what's going wrong when you're all happy doing it. But they are so diverse, depending on whether you marry or cohabit, that it seems to be a big gap. And that's not to say we shouldn't change the law. We absolutely should be looking at the cohabitation laws, but that's not going to happen quickly, is it? We know from how long it's taken to get no-fault divorce through that getting the law changed is a gargantuan task.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you say there that you are changing legally, that you're entering into a contract when you marry, let's be honest. And I think that that is completely lost. And there's this romantic notion about, you know, the cake and the dress and the venue and everything else. And there's no time afforded to actually let's understand the legal implications of that. And as you say, let's also understand the legal implications of not marrying and moving in. You know, lots of people that I come across have maybe owned their own property. They meet somebody, they sell their property and invest their equity into that person's property because they're going to be moving in with them. And then they potentially lose it. You know, it just beggars belief. And there's not one person that comes to me, I can say this hand on heart, Kate, in a client capacity, that knows a lot of this stuff. You know, they will come to me and say, okay, the reason they're coming to me is because they need to understand their legal position. And as you say, quite rightly, we have to communicate that. There should be more done prior to marriages or moving in together, perhaps at school age. I don't know. There should be, you know, in the last year of school, let's look at the legal implications, because honestly, it's going to impact every single one of us. Every one of us are either going to end up in a cohabiting relationship or we're going to get married. Chances are there's very few that actually go through life solitary.
Or not all the way through. And even short periods of cohabitation or marriage can have big financial consequences and impacts, can't they?
Absolutely.
Listen, I could talk forever about this. I've got so many more myths that definitely need busting. So I'm going to invite you back for another one, because I've got another 5 or 10 that we need to go through, because they're just ones that I hear all the time. And I'm really interested to know, fact or fiction, myth or not. Yeah. So I'm going to wrap it up for there now, Tracy. But thank you so much for coming on and for talking to me. Where can people find you on social media?
So the Legal Queen, she's on TikTok, she is on Instagram, YouTube. I think if you just go into any of those platforms and search for the Legal Queen, you'll find her.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. And of course, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kate_Daly. You can hear about new podcast episodes by following at divorce_podcast. And if you want to hear more from me or more from Tracy in an upcoming episode, you can download and subscribe to the podcast by visiting thedivorcepodcast.com. Thanks so much, Tracy, for your time. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Kate. Thank you. Bye-bye.